Hills, thank you very much for joining us. It's great to have you in Australia. Short trip down under for you. Jan is the founder of Head, Heart Plus Brain, an organisation that helps other organisations based on the latest understanding of neuroscience. Jan, welcome to Australia.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
We've turned on the English weather for you in Sydney at the moment, although I don't think it ever rains this heavily in the UK. But great to have you here. We were keen to talk to you today for sort of 15 minutes or so about your latest understanding of neuroscience, how it can be applied to the workplace to help organisations to maximise performance. So can you give us just a really quick background as to how you got into this space and what sort of work you're doing and the impact that you're having on the organisations that you work with?
Yep. So my background is investment banking. When being in investment banking was a desirable career. And I started consulting around performance and leadership about 20 years ago. We got into neuroscience really because we were finding, particularly in the change space, that nothing worked. So we went off and looked for something that would work, did a project using the idea of, you know, how the brain responds to change,
yes,
and found that we got much, much better results. And
right.
Since then, that was back in 2009, since then we've spread that into all the work that we do.
Yeah.
So our name stands for, we use the kind of rational, logical business content. We get people involved at the heart level, so the buy-in and the emotional level, and the brain pieces, primarily neuroscience.
Yeah, fantastic. And so when companies come to you for help, what are they typically presenting?
Typically, I'd say they have a leadership team that they want to be more effective. Often they have done lots of leadership development and got no results or very limited results. So a typical scenario we will hear is that people have spent a lot of money on a leadership program, but the behaviors haven't changed.
Yes.
And one of the things we've really focused on is understanding what happens in your brain when you make behavioral change.
Yes.
And
yeah.
How do we design our interventions with leaders to follow that?
Yeah. And so why are companies spending so much money on this and getting it wrong? What are they doing wrong when it comes to developing leaders at the moment?
So in the main, I think they're going for, you know, saturation.
Yeah.
So they're giving tons of content, often fairly theoretical,
yep,
models and so on, that is increasing people's knowledge but not the behavioural change. In
yes.
order to get behavioural change, you need to ensure people want to change.
Yes.
They can see what's in it for them.
Yes.
You need to create insight, not tell people what the answer is. We're much more likely to take action based on our own insight.
Yes.
You need to embed that insight into something that's kind of practical and real for that leader.
Yes.
And then you need to follow through for long enough until it becomes a new habit, a new way of working. And if you put leaders on a one-day training program, stuff them full of knowledge,
yep,
and then expect something to happen,
yes,
forget it. We know it doesn't happen,
yeah,
but unfortunately people keep doing it because that's their habit.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's how they learned as well, or didn't learn, as
the case may be.
And what does the follow-through look like? So how can we leverage neuroscience to understand what effective follow-through?
So some of the things we do would be we set up social learning groups so that people are actually holding each other to account for their change.
Yeah.
But they're also kind of gaining in status and reputation if they make that change with their peers,
yes,
with people who matter to them. We, you know, just simple things like prompts and reminders in that context. We know from Matt Lieberman's work, that when people teach other people, they're much more likely to, you know, embed that learning and that new behaviour themselves.
Yes.
And they will understand it much more deeply.
Absolutely.
When they've had to get their team to understand it and get their team to also adopt those new behaviours.
Yeah, fantastic. And one of the things you mentioned before was this concept of using neuroscience to help organisations to work through change. So leadership development aside, change is everywhere. It's increasing in speed, complexity, ambiguity, all those things that we talk about. How can we use neuroscience to understand how to help our people and ourselves, for that matter, to work through change more effectively?
Yeah. I think the first thing, the first aha moment for most people is understanding that when you ask someone to change, it's actually painful in your brain. Mm. You know, we know that now. And when people feel that discomfort, that sense of threat, if you like, they're going to do one of three things. Mm-hmm. They're either going to fight it.
Yes.
They're going to resist it. Mm. Or they're going to bury their heads in the sand and just freeze their activity and not adopt the new change. So I think if we look at change in that context, we can start to help people to have a different reaction. So some of the things that we've found are effective with both individuals and multiplying it up with organisations is to get people much more involved in what does this change mean for me, and how do I kind of adapt what I'm doing as opposed to being told what to do? How do I set goals that I get some rewards for so I keep going with the change? And at an organizational level, how do you persuade leaders that what feels good for them, because they've already worked through all of issues on the change, they need to sort of step back and put themselves in the shoes of their employees and really push the change forward or engage those employees with the change from where they're at, not where the leader's at, which is often quite a big gap because they've been sitting in the boardroom kind of talking and planning the change and getting themselves
why aren't people embracing it hours after letting them know about it?
And then, you know, all the classic issues with change, like people communicate it once and expect everyone to have got it. They think, you know, if they tell them in a very rah-rah way, they'd be more excited about doing it. And actually slowing down that early stage and really getting people to kind of find out what's in it for me seems to work a lot better. And being smart about it. There's some interesting modelling research that's been done that if you get 10% of true believers, and particularly if those 10% of true believers have a distributed network around the organisation, your change will happen much more easily. If everything's sort of in a point at the CEO, and it's just that person's messaging, you're going to make life much more difficult for yourself.
So if the 10% is all sort of up the top or in one component, one part of the business, that's not as helpful as the 10% being spread out. So finding those hubs of the wheel as such is kind of handy.
Particularly if it's a big change where you're expecting people to kind of completely redo their jobs differently.
Yes.
Look at what's kind of seen as valuable and successful differently.
Yeah, fantastic. The other thing we talked about before starting this conversation was the idea of energy. So, you know, everybody's sort of feeling burnt out these days. They're being pulled in a million different directions. What can we learn from neuroscience around maintaining energy in a day and age when everyone wants a piece of us and there never seems to be enough time to go around?
So I think the biggest thing that is a shock for people is how limited the energy of your brain is.
Yeah.
So our prefrontal cortex will get depleted very quickly. And we use an analogy of a bank account.
Yes.
So if you wake up in the morning and you've got $10,000 in your bank account, but most of what you probably do first thing in the morning is coming out of your habit system. So it's relatively low levels of energy depletion. So you clean your teeth, you have your breakfast, you take your normal route to work.
Yes.
You come into work, and if you then start problem solving, writing a kind of taxing report, you know, having a debate with your CEO, you're beginning to deplete that, especially that prefrontal cortex energy. So by mid-morning, you could be down to about $2,000 in your metaphorical bank account.
Yes.
And your brain needs to then replenish that energy, so replenish that. And so when you start finding yourself kind of filing your emails or wandering around the office, not doing very much, when you know you've got a really important deadline that you should be working on, that's probably a signal that you've depleted that kind of prefrontal cortex energy.
Yes.
And taking a break will be much more productive than trying to push on through.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think one of the things, you know, if people do one thing in business, taking more micro breaks, they would actually, you know, counterintuitively find that they're more productive. Yeah.
I really like that idea of sprints, which is kind of the opposite of what you're talking about, but it absolutely complementary in terms of thinking about a sort of a 60-minute sprint and really knowing that after that 60 minutes, I'll have a break for and recover, replenish, whatever the terminology is. And, you know, I think too often we think we can sprint all day. And, of course, we can't. Yeah. It just, it's not physically or cognitively possible.
And when you look at two people who work in those different ways, so the sprint all day person and the sprint and break person, what you'll find is the sprint all day person is actually making more mistakes and having to do rework, and their productivity is actually less.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and the kind of sprint and recover is what high performers do.
Absolutely right, yeah. We see it in the physical world, but we think in the business world it's different. In the athletic world, I understand how they train, but I'm a corporate athlete and I can do things differently. But it's actually a very similar context.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I understand that there are sort of other aspects to that energy model that you talk about. Can you tell us a little bit about
that? So, three other aspects. So how do people manage their emotional energy? You know, as a Brit, we suppress that. We know that that's the worst thing you can do because it actually increases amygdala activity.
And what does that mean?
So it means that when you come across a similar trigger for your negative emotion, for example, you will feel that more strongly and have less control over it if you've suppressed it the first time. So undertaking different types of strategies, like reframing what that kind of issue might really mean, what might be sort of some positive that can come out of it, taking distance from it, saying to yourself, how will I feel about this in 6 months' time? Will it be as emotionally difficult for me?
Yes.
We know from Kevin Oshner's work, who's a neuroscientist, that those things really work.
Yes.
And they generalize. So once you start doing that, you're more able to do it again.
Yes.
And you'll be able to do it in more and more circumstances.
Yeah.
Not just work, for example.
Yes, of course.
The other forms of energy, obviously physical energy, we're seeing a lot around sleep.
Yes. People are really variable.
Beginning to understand the impact of not sleeping.
Yes.
Or having
I blame Churchill for that one. Didn't Churchill only sleep 2 hours a day?
Well, I'm Margaret Thatcher.
And Thatcher as well. So another famous Brit. They set a very terrible standard for everyone else.
So, you know, they got stiff upper lip wrong and they got their sleep patterns wrong as well. And then the final one that we work with leaders on is around their purposeful energy. So having some meaning in their work,
and
how do you create that meaning? How do you actually kind of get a sense of purpose around what you're doing when it can feel like a treadmill? And again, we know from some of the research that when you've got meaning, you maintain more energy.
So physical, purposeful, mental, and emotional.
Correct.
They're sort of the four levels to think about in terms of building your energy. Fantastic. Another topic which I know you're passionate about are gender differences. So is there really any science behind this sort of Mars and Venus, you know, men and women thinking differently, or is it just sort of popular pop psychology as such?
Well, it's interesting you say that because we're doing a research for a book at the moment called Brain Savvy Woman, and it's looking at gender in the workplace. So I'm deeply immersed in the research around the female brain and the male brain.
Yeah.
So there are lots of popular books that would have you believe that the male and female brain is different.
Yes.
And that that is the reason for some of the differences in male and female leadership and so on. When you really dig into that research, most of it's rubbish. And what the differences tend to stem from is stereotyping. So we live up to our stereotypes.
Yes.
So women live up to a stereotype of being nice, of, you know, not being very good at maths, of being slightly more kind of relationship orientated and so on.
Yeah.
Men live up to a stereotype of needing to be, you know, a bit more aggressive, a bit more kind of driven, a bit less caring about other people. When you put people into a situation where they're relieved of those stereotypes, so where a female leader, for example, is kind of given the signal, given priming that, you know, being too nice here won't get you where you need to be, people go much more into kind of what they truly believe they're good at, and will those stereotypes start falling away.
So sort of unconscious bias being applied to yourself.
Absolutely.
In many ways.
Absolutely.
And so physically the brain isn't different between men and women?
There are tiny differences, but the evidence that that really results in different behavior is not there.
Right. So it's more belief systems than cognitive structure.
They're going to have much more impact than kind of minute differences in some of the kind of, in inverted commas, wiring.
And the good news is we can do something about it then.
Yeah, well,
more easily than we could if it was structural.
Potentially. There's a fantastic program on at the moment in the UK called The Secret Life of 5-Year-Olds.
Right.
They looked at gender at five.
Yes.
And it's so embedded even at that level. So if we really want to undo this, we've got to do some intensive work around
very
helping
early.
People understand what's the stereotypes I've absorbed.
Yes.
Do they serve me or not?
Yeah.
Some of them may serve you in certain circumstances.
Yeah, sure.
And do I want to make the change? And that's really what the book's going to be about.
Fantastic. Watch this space. Looking forward to reading it.
Thank you.
And just to settle a dispute at home, my wife always says she can multitask way better than I can. Is there any truth to that rumor that women can multitask better than men?
Absolutely they can. That's the stereotype.
Because it's a stereotype, though, not because it's okay. Fantastic. Thanks for clarifying that one. Final topic I was keen to bring up was decision-making. Again, from a cognitive perspective, how can we make better decisions? And you've just sort of described an example of decision-making based on unconscious bias and stereotypes that we're not even aware of. What can we do in the workplace beyond just those sort of the gender side of things, but to make better decisions every day, what can we learn from neuroscience to help us to do that more effectively?
So I think two things is actually help people understand how you make decisions.
Yeah.
There is no such thing as a purely rational decision.
Yeah.
They're all based on emotion at some level.
Yes.
And within that, then to put in, it's less about what the individual does and more about what's your decision-making kind of structure and process in the organization, to put checks and balances in that help people to kind of check, make sure that they're not putting bias into their decisions, for example.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, you can, bias is unconscious. You can't train people to be less biased in the main. What you can do is, you know, have blind CVs, have someone else kind of second look at the decision-making on a big investment, for example. So getting into the habit of putting those things into the decision-making process really helps.
Yes.
I think the other thing that really helps at an individual level is just slow down.
Yeah.
Give yourself some time to reflect.
Space.
Yeah, we know that even a few minutes reflection means that people make better decisions when there's a lot of very complex information to consider.
Yes. Yeah, and that's a topic that I'm very I've talked to a number of people about as well, is this idea of creating quiet time in your life. We're just bombarded by so many things, and particularly with smartphone technology and all the rest, we're always on. My kids wake up and they're straight on their devices. The last thing they do at night is check their device,
Yeah.
go to Snapchat. What's happening in the world? I mean, for our kids and for us as well. We're just finding it harder and harder to find that quiet space anymore.
We're out of the habit. So, if you think 70% of what you do is habit,
Yes.
you haven't built that into your life.
Yes.
And in order to do, to have more quiet time to reflect, to just, zone out for a while,
Yes.
you need to build that back into your life.
Yes.
And I think one of the most interesting pieces of research that businesses should be hooking onto
Yes.
is that when we mind wander, our
Yes.
brain is actually more active than when we're in focused attention.
Right.
And all that activity is solving kind of the issues that you've been unable to solve
Yes.
in that focused attention.
Yeah.
So it's kind of free time for the
Yeah.
organization.
Yeah.
So, insist people have mind wandering times.
Yeah.
Make them
Yeah.
go for a walk around the block with their
Yeah.
coffee.
Yeah.
Get people to kind of take breaks because
Yeah.
you're getting all that free time, and
Yeah.
that's often where creative insights come.
Yeah. Love it. I love it. And that prompts me to something else you've talked about is coaching on the go. So slightly related concept.
Yeah.
So when you're in a coaching scenario, walking around seems to be the way to go.
It does. I mean, we've done this kind of, experimentally with our own programs and people on those programs. And it seems to be because our brain developed kind of walking
Yeah.
in the main,
Yeah.
that we're somehow more able to kind of see possibilities when there's that bit of physical activity that
Yes.
while we're pondering it. And there's also something about, and I, you know, this is experiential rather than kind of proven research, that when people are walking side by side and they're not having to look each other in the eye, there's a kind of a bit more willingness to go deeper into difficult
Yes.
scenarios.
Yes.
So the feedback we get from our participants when they do walking on the go is they go much deeper with a problem,
Yes.
and then they have more kind of open ideas about what they can do about it.
Yeah.
And there's more motivation to then kind of take some action around it.
It's fantastic insight. Never thought about doing that, but it makes
There we
a
are.
lot of sense.
Free
Well,
tools.
yeah, absolutely. Jan Hills, thank you very much for your time today. Thanks for helping us to understand how we can apply neuroscience into the workplace. And so much of what you've described is relevant to us outside of work as well, of course. So
Absolutely.
I'll be walking more with my kids and coaching them as I try to on a regular basis. It normally fails dismally, of course, as a dad. They never listen to me. But maybe walking with them on and coaching on the go is the way to go. But I really appreciate your time telling us about Brain Savvy Business today. And please check out Jan's website, which is, we'll send the link out to you, but you can type into your Google search engine, head, heart, plus brain, and that will get you there. There's some great videos on there as well, explaining more around how neuroscience can benefit you and your organizations. Thanks very much for joining us on this podcast. Thanks, Jan, to you.
Thank you. It's great to be in Australia.
Enjoy your time out here.
Thank you.